You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is impossible to overstate the irony that St. Valentine's Day, a holiday that celebrates love, is the day of one of the most infamous massacres in American criminal history. It happened on this day in 1929. Six gangsters and an optician who liked to hang out with gangsters were gathered in an unheated garage on Chicago's North Side. Suddenly, two men burst in, holding a shotgun dressed as cops. They ordered everyone to line up and face the wall.
Then the uniformed pair ushered in two men in long, heavy overcoats, from under which they produced two Thompson submachine guns. Perhaps the weapons were handed off to the uniformed officers, but more likely the new arrivals held onto the guns themselves. Either way, the Tommy guns were raised and leveled at the backs of the seven men leaned against a cold brick wall.
That's Brad Schwartz reading from his book Scarface and the Untouchable Al Capone, Elliot Ness and the Battle for Chicago.
But the Thompson could fire 600 rounds every minute, and when the first Tommy gun opened fire, all 50 of its rounds were spent within 5 seconds. The harsh chatter of machine gun fire filled the tight space as the gunman raked his Thompson back and forth, huge jets of flame leaping from the muzzle, strobing the garage as a hail of 45s caught the gangsters first in their heads, then across their backs.
And believe it or not, nobody was ever brought to justice in the St. Valentine's Day massacre, but that's where this bloody story takes a turn that winds up in West Michigan, in St. Joseph. Chris Lyon is with us, a Berrien County 911 supervisor and historian. Her book is A Killing in Capone's Playground, the true story of the hunt for the most dangerous man alive. Chris, it is pretty astonishing to think no arrests, no convictions in this massacre.
Absolutely. And it's hard to believe that it was actually 90 years ago today, and today being Thursday, and it was actually a Thursday when the massacre took place. So it's even more ironic.
And remind us again, why did this happen? Who was gunning for whom?
Well, this seemed to be always thought to be the product of the Prohibition era beer wars. And they were really between the two arch rivals that were known at the time, Bugs Moran and Al Capone. And there were really very few witnesses that had come forward for the massacre, and not really many others stuck around. And a lot of people were afraid to speak. Not many people that wanted to speak to the police. Not many people wanted to speak to anybody else. So they really didn't have a whole lot of evidence to go on. And the police and the officials at the time only had what was at the scene of the crime, which were the bullets and the casings to go on.
And good heavens, they had a lot of those, didn't they?
Oh, they certainly did. And a lot of other, as Brad described, a lot of the gross part of it, too.
Yes, absolutely. So take us down 10 months later. What happened December 14th, 1929?
Yeah, and that's the ironic part, that it was actually 10 months later. And this is in southwestern Michigan in St. Joseph, a young police officer by the name of Charles Skelly. He was confronted by a motorist who wasn't exactly on the up and up. He was shot and killed by this motorist. And it was really unknown at the time, but they found a crashed car about a mile away. Officers looked inside the vehicle, found a receipt for a lumber yard with an address on it. And they went to this address, which was about a mile or so down the road in a small town called Stevensville. And they found a bungalow home, and it was owned by a man named Fred Killer Burke, who they would later find out was related to the St. Valentine's Day massacre. And it was at this point where they realized that there were gangsters living amongst us, if you could believe that or not. And it was filled with all the tools of the trade, Thompson submachine guns, bulletproof vests, stolen bonds, booze, disguised as you name it, he had it. Hmm. And he was prepared.
And how was it that they came to piece together that Fred Burke was connected with what happened, this massacre in Chicago 10 months earlier?
Well, he had actually been named as a suspect early on. But then again, they were naming everybody as a suspect. If you lived in Chicago and you'd ever been arrested or you ever had any connection with Al Capone, you were pretty much a suspect. But in this case, they had actually named him as a suspect, and they thought of him as possibly involved because of an earlier connection with Al Capone and a man that was shot in Brooklyn, New York, that Al had hired him for. So when it came up to the idea that this was a connection action, they found a fingerprint on a salt shaker in this bungalow house. They found it, connected it up with the Chicago fingerprints, the old-fashioned fingerprint ink and card method, and they connected them up to be Fred Killer Burke. And he not only was the killer of this young police officer named Charles Skelly, but it turned out he also had two Thompson submachine guns that we thought Chicago was very interested in. So what we did was we had the two detectives from the Berrien County Sheriff's Office take these two Thompson submachine guns via train to Chicago, where a man named Colonel Calvin Goddard, who was the renowned godfather of this new science called forensic ballistics, and it was pretty much a new science, he was there testing the evidence at the time. And when we brought him the Thompson submachine guns that were found in Burke's house, they ended up testing positive. They matched up with all the bullets and all the casings that were found in the garage that day on February 14th, 90 years ago today, if you believe it or not.
And, you know, isn't it something we take it for granted now? Oh, well, ballistics tests and it's important forensic evidence. That was really groundbreaking.
Yes, and you think about it, we watch that on TV every day. Everything on TV today is about ballistics and science and DNA, and even the DNA testing is something that it took a while for us to get used to, but back then, this was brand new stuff. They almost called it a junk science because people really didn't believe that this was something that could be used. And believe it or not, this is kind of a groundbreaking case. And if it weren't for the fact that Charles Skelly from St. Joseph, Michigan, was shot and killed that night, we never would have found those guns, and we never would have been able to prove that they were connected to this major crime, which, again, you said, has never been solved to this date, 90 years ago, and all of that happened. And it was a connection to Michigan that very few people know about. And I think it's our job today to make sure that we get that word out, that we helped solve a massacre that has never been solved. But I think that we at least know who one suspect is.
Right. And was Fred Burke ever found, ever captured, ever charged?
He was found. Actually, he did take off. He left the area, and we think he might have left going towards Detroit, but we aren't positive. But he did leave the area, and he was eventually caught and captured in Missouri, in a small town, Green City, Missouri, about a year and a half later. And because of the fact that we had a strong case against him, the governor of Missouri decided that we could extradite him back to Berrien County. And that's where he was brought back to. Now, you'll hear a different version of the story from the Chicago authorities in Cook County, because they'll say we stole him from them. But there was nobody willing to speak on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. No one was willing to testify. But we had witnesses and lots of evidence, of course, from the house that we could actually put him on the stand and have him convicted. And he was actually grateful to come back to Michigan because, of course, we did not have the death penalty in 1929, 1931, when he was actually brought back. And he would spend the rest of his life in Marquette State Penitentiary. And, of course, that was probably one of the nice places to be, probably as far away from Chicago or Detroit as you could get back then, up on the shores of Lake Superior. And that's where he spent the rest of his life, and he died in 1940. So his life sentence was about 9 years when he was convicted.
And just to be clear, this was for the murder of Officer Skelly and not for what happened in Chicago?
Yes. Fred Killer Burke was actually found guilty of second-degree murder through the Berrien County court system.
And as you say, Cook County is unhappy in a way because, as you, from their point of view, you got him for Skelly. We couldn't put him up for what happened to those folks, the victims of the St. Valentine's Massacre. So the two Tommy guns, ballistics tests proved they were used in that garage there on Clark Street in Chicago on St. Valentine's Day for the massacre. What has become of the two Tommy guns?
Well, the Tommy guns were found in Berrien County. Therefore, they belong to Berrien County, and they still belong to Berrien County, and they are still with us today. A lot of the items that were found at that house on that day in December have been kind of piecemealed away through the years, lost through time, but those Tommy guns have not been lost. They have remained in the custody under lock and key in the arsenal of the Berrien County Sheriff's Office. They spent a very short stint at Quantico at the FBI Academy. We managed to get them back, and this was in the 1970s. But they're used in presentations almost weekly. We have a very good response from people that want to see them. They don't want them in museums, and they want to be able to have these come out. So we have them around the United States have presentations with them. People want to get up and close and personal with them. They want to see them up close. They don't want to see them behind glass where you couldn't touch them, you couldn't get up close to them. This way, we can actually take them apart. We can show you all the original parts that are there. I have shot them before. They are amazing. They are full of history. They are, in fact, priceless artifacts. And to think that I got to shoot them, it was an honor. I am always grateful for that. But we try to kind of restrict that now because they are very old, and we have to look at it. Again, these are over 90 years old because it was when they were just when they were last used.
Sure.
For 90 years ago.
But I've got to wonder if the public wouldn't want to see them. I take it they're being basically shown to law enforcement officers, or is the public able to go to these presentations and see them?
The public is very welcome. In fact, we've even taken them to schools and taught the children in certain grade levels what these guns are for. And, you know, we're not certainly not trying to promote guns. We're not trying to promote anything along those lines. We're trying to show that this is an era. This was the Prohibition era, the 1920s, the Roaring 20s. And these are what the gangsters used. This was a time period. And we are coming up on the next Roaring 20s, if you want to think of it too that way. But these were guns that were taken off the streets, and they will never kill again. And that's how we look at it. And we were proud of the fact that Berrien County served these guys the justice that they didn't get anywhere else in the country. We want to be able to say that this was something that we did, and in Michigan. And these guns are favorites at the NRA shows. They're favorites at other shows. Gun collectors, history buffs are just totally into it. The Thompson Submachine Gun Collectors Group thinks of these as like the Ark and anything else.
The Holy Grail of gun collecting.
The Holy Grail, anything. They just think these are the biggest thing in the world. And, you know, I look at it, and you have to really take in the history of it, because these aren't just guns. These are pieces of history. You have to look beyond what they were used for, but you have to think of it as this was something that people used, and it was a time period, and it's a piece of our history. And I think we need to teach people the history of this. And this era was, in particular, a very violent era, gangsters shooting other gangsters. Today, we have people just shooting random people. So I think it's a good way to show the difference between the different eras.
Chris Lyon is a Berrien County 911 supervisor. Her book is A Killing in Capone's Playground, The True Story of the Hunt for the Most Dangerous Man Alive, marking this 90th anniversary of Chicago's St. Valentine's Day Massacre and the trail that led right to Berrien County. Chris, thanks for speaking with us on Stateside.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.